When Alan Proctor's older brother, Bruce, went AWOL from the Air National Guard in 1968 in protest of the Vietnam War, their resulting correspondence captured a distinctive time in American history.
As soon as Bruce went to Sweden, he started sending me letters, and Bruce was a fabulous writer. He could be enigmatic, playful, cynical, philosophical, all in one paragraph. And I knew these letters were special.
That's why Alan Proctor kept them in a file drawer. 35 years later, he began compiling his military family's story of that era. The Sweden File, Memoir of an American Expatriate, now in its second edition in 2019 from Open Books Press, also contains recent essays reflecting back. I'm Angela Elam, and I'll talk with Alan Proctor in the second half of this edition of New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, which has published some of his poetry. After the memoir first came out from Westphalia Press, KCUR's C.J. Genevieve talked with Alan Proctor in 2016 about crafting the book.
When you went back and found the letters in the file cabinet and decided you're going to compile this into a manuscript, you send that to him and you ask him to reminisce on his youthful correspondence, which he did. And you say that he took your suggestion to heart and recounted a more complete panorama of his banishment.
Yes. The book is told in three narrative voices. There are the letters themselves, and there are dozens and dozens of them, mostly from him, but several letters to him. Then there are his recollections from about three or four decades later in 2008, 2009. I asked him to talk more about the letters. They remained in a drawer for decades. And when I brought them back out, I said, Bruce, tell me what was really going on in your mind. This letter sounds terribly optimistic, or this letter hints at this. The first thing he sent back was a story in third person. And I said, no. That's not what I want. What I want is your story. Tell me what's really happening. So he did that brilliantly. And when I got those back in 2008, 2009, I knew I had a book. So I started to gather my own thoughts about my issues with the Vietnam War and some of the things that Bruce wouldn't say in his letters, like his background perhaps and our background as a family. And I put those in the book. Those are the three narrative voices, the letters, his later reminiscences, and then my comments and observations. His story and his journey is rather harrowing. At an early age, he worked at the Pentagon with the Defense Intelligence Agency, and by age 24, he had top secret clearance working in the Pentagon. In 1967, he was interpreting aerial photography taken over Vietnam, and what he saw horrified him because there were dead civilians, there were bomb craters on unauthorized flight paths. And he decided, even though his ambition from an early age was to be Secretary of State, and he was well on his way, he decided that he couldn't work for a government that was involved in this kind of war. So he told the DIA, I'm quitting. And the DIA said, you can't quit. You have to be debriefed, and that will take 6 months. And my brother said, no, I'm leaving tomorrow. And he did. So there he was, a civilian on the street with top secret information, and he was counseled by friends to join the Air National Guard because the Air National Guards at that time were not being sent into foreign combat. So he joined the Air National Guard, but within a few months, President Johnson nationalized his unit and several others with orders to go to Vietnam. So he went AWOL, got on a plane, and flew to Stockholm, Sweden for humanitarian asylum. He lived in Stockholm for 4 years, from 1968 to 1972. And his first letters back were highly optimistic. But as it turned out, life was not at all easy for him during those 4 years.
As you were getting those letters home, what did you think about what he was going through? Were you wondering about his state of mind?
Well, I could certainly feel his pain. Bruce could be enigmatic, philosophical, funny, all in one paragraph. And there were times when he strayed off into the mystical, and it's in a few of these letters. His writing could also be beautifully lyrical. As his younger brother, I was just in awe of him and when I got those kind of letters, I would write him back and just try and communicate with him. I didn't really understand or know about his writing ability until I graduated college and I started publishing a little bit, and that's what I wanted to do. And when I got his letters, I knew these were something special. And what's interesting is when I decided to start collecting them in the early 70s, I had kept all of his letters. So I thought, well, maybe other people kept them. Everybody I contacted had kept his letters because they were just so interesting. I think people knew that these were historical documents. So gathering letters in that way was pretty easy because everybody had them. I actually, in 75, I took the letters to a friend of ours, Dick Grossman. He was head of Grossman Publishers in New York. And I said, what do you think? And he said, well, they're fascinating and they're certainly interesting, but they're not quite timely. This is 1975. And he said, and there's really no arc to this book except the letters. We need a little bit more than that. So I got on with my life and put them in a drawer. I had transcribed them on a Royal Manual typewriter. There's a thick file. I still have it. And I didn't put them into a Word document until, 2008, 2009.
Is there one or two that just really jump out to you, some of your favorites?
Well, maybe what I should do is read his first letter. It's Chapter 1, AWOL, Saturday, July 13th, 1968, posted in New York City. Dear folks, there was reason, after all, for resignation to my fate. If I had really planned to go, I would have been very morbid. I have no desire to assist in the death of people. The war in Vietnam is irrational, immoral, and stupid. I'm on the bus to New York, where I'll fly to Stockholm, Sweden tonight. Rosemary, who was his brand new wife, will follow in 3 to 4 weeks after liquidating our modest property. I'll write as soon as I have an address in Stockholm. We know people there, so I'll be staying with friends. My first problem will be the language, but the government has free courses. There will be no problem with working. The Swedish law is very liberal with political refugees. They enjoy a sanctuary. Naturally, I do not plan to return unless there is eventually a legal way to do it. The Swedes run a rational social order, so there will be no problem with ordinary amenities of health and living. My strength and certainty that this is the right decision grows. I can feel that it is right. I do not seek an escape or transformation. I'm merely changing my territorial basis.
Alan Proctor, reading from the memoir, The Sweden File, on New Letters on the Air. Again, here's C.J. Janovee.
His writing is so powerful. Mm. His words are so strong. And the emotions that he evokes are so universal for anyone who's left home.
Right.
He's thinking that he's never coming back, and you're thinking of him leaving and maybe never seeing him again. Is that what you're feeling as you're reading?
Yes, because he never did except to visit, and he at the time didn't know if he would ever be able to return. He was very paranoid at first, because he knew that if he did return, they'd probably put him in prison or worse, particularly in the first few weeks when his top secret clearance was still problematic. Luckily, for a lot of us, I guess, President Carter, on his second day in office, reviewed a lot of the dishonorable discharges. For humanitarian reasons, he upgraded many of them to less than honorable discharges, and my brother's was one of them. So he was able to come back and at least visit. And that letter from Jimmy Carter to my brother, luckily he saved that, and we were able to include that.
Does it have Carter's signature? Is it Bruce's signature?
Actually, it's the letter that Bruce wrote to Jimmy Carter 2 months before he died in 2011 that said, I just wanted to thank you for upgrading his dishonorable discharge. And he said, before it's too late for either of us. Carter at that time was, I guess, 90 years old or close to that. And Carter wrote back on Bruce's letter, thanks for your letter. Glad to hear from you, Jimmy Carter. Nice of the man.
Yeah. We're reading Bruce's letters from this long distance, 40 years, if not more, which now feels like perspective. How does the passage of time change how you read those letters when you're thinking about putting them into a manuscript?
Well, I think at first they were just fascinating letters. But when I retired and I started writing myself full time in the way I wanted to write my poetry and my stories and my novel and so forth, I realized that this book could be one of historical significance now that all of those decades had passed. What's interesting is it was published by Westphalia Press in 2015, which was the 40th anniversary of the United States leaving rather ignominiously from Saigon and leaving Vietnam. So I did see it as a historical text. That's what time will do, I guess.
When you were putting them in the Word doc,
yeah,
how did it feel to reread them at that point?
I was really excited, and I knew I was onto something. And I thought, thank you, younger self, for keeping these letters. And I think as soon as I kind of put them all together on a Word doc, I said, okay, Bruce has to look again at these. He had his own life in Canada. He was living in Winnipeg, and he was at that time one of six or seven undersecretaries of education for the province of Manitoba. So in a way, he did become the political leader that he wanted, rather a mid-level bureaucrat, but that did happen for him to a certain extent in Canada. And when he started sending me back his reminiscences, I could not believe his ability to remember, because it's so clear. It's as though he wrote them the next day after certain letters. It's fascinating. I don't know how he did that.
Were you still living in the same house with your mom and dad when these letters arrived? And were you able to see your folks' reaction to getting this first letter or the ones that came right after that?
I was living on my own, but I was in the same town. In fact, there is a letter here from my father, which might be interesting to read. My father was a retired naval captain, a four-striper, as they say. And he had been in the hospital for a while, and he came home, and my mother didn't tell him right away about the situation. This is Wednesday, July 24th, 1968, about 10 days after Bruce left. Dear Bruce, this is the first time I have sat down to write to anyone since returning from the hospital last Thursday. However, Mom didn't tell me until later. My immediate reaction was one of shock and fear. Shock at the realization of the courage it took to make a decision with such lifelong consequences, and fear of the long arm of the CIA and FBI taking possible defensive action against one in possession of classified information.
So your father's very practical but very admiring.
Indeed.
Was that how your folks were, just kind of very realistic about things? Were they happier that he was maybe gone, never to be seen again as long as he was alive?
Yes, I suppose. There was a critical moment there, and I heard about this from my sister, who said that when my father first heard that Bruce was about to leave, he told my mother that because he was a high-ranking officer, he would have to turn him in. And my mother said, if you do that, I'm leaving you. So that was the end of that discussion.
His letters back, they sort of alternate between this joy of discovery of this new place, alternating with this sort of despair about what to do with his life there.
Yes.
And in that sense, as a book, it really does feel like it captures this moment in U.S. history, but from this European distance,
right,
looking back.
Right. Perspective from an expatriate.
Alan Proctor with C.J. Janovee in 2016. The Sweden File, Memoir of an American Expatriate, features letters and commentaries by and about his brother, Bruce Stevens Proctor, who died in 2011. For New Letters on the Air, I'm Angela Elam. In 2018, the Kansas City Actors Theater asked me to interview a local poet to accompany their production of the epistolary play Sea Marks. I immediately thought of this book and Alan Proctor, the poetry editor of Kansas City Voices magazine. We'll hear one of his poems later, but first, here's his 2014 essay from the section of the memoir titled Notes on the Revolution.
By the end of my junior year at Earlham in 1969, a dozen draft boards had been firebombed, the avenue of 100 American cities set ablaze. In dormitories and classrooms around the country, armed students stood guard against college administrations whom they accused of collaborating with the military-industrial complex. America's a war zone, a friend told me. Vietnam has been anglicized. A political science major with whom I had unrequitedly slept put it to me this way. The police bash your friend's head in at the Democratic National Convention, and he gets the best doctors, the best attorneys. He's dismissed as a hippie sowing his political oats. A black man gets his head bashed at the same demonstration, and the world says, God help us, another nigger with the absurd notion that he's free to express dissent. We were lying together in a state of semi-nudity. She smelled like apples. He can't afford a hospital, she said. Can't afford a lawyer. So they put him in jail as a terrorist. You may think two separate swords are chopping up America, the political one and the racial one, but there's only one blade, prejudice. And it doesn't lose its edge. It's been sharp for a long time. Imperialism or the Ku Klux Klan, it's the same sword underneath the hood and white robes. She stroked my cheek, said, I gotta go to class, and kissed my forehead.
Alan Robert Proctor reading from the book The Sweden File, Memoir of an Expatriate. You know, I was really struck in this book by the letters from his parents. And his mother, Ella May Proctor, was a beautiful writer. The very first letter from her in this book is really gripping. It's too long to read the entire thing, but I just found out from Alan that his mother had been a playwright. So why don't you talk a little bit about her, and then I thought maybe you could read a bit of her letter.
My mother went to college at 16. She was very bright. She graduated with a master's degree, and she won some awards for her playwriting. But in those days, in the late 30s, when you married and you started having children, you didn't accept a job, at least she didn't, even though she was well-educated and had in mind to be a playwright. So she raised four kids, but whenever she could, she got into community theater, and she ended up directing a lot of community theater. July 27, 1968, this is about less than 2 weeks after Bruce left. My darling Bruce, after you said goodbye to me and we watched the plane almost out of sight, I had the feeling that it was not true, that you could not be going to Vietnam. Your attitude at home was not one of belligerence, as it should have been, and quiet acceptance has never been your way. When I got your letter through Rosemary, that's my brother's wife, Bob was in the hospital, and I decided for several reasons not to tell him about it until he had several good nights of rest, which he needed. He was at home on Friday, the 19th, when Sergeant Bush called to say you had not come in for processing, and he asked me when you arrived here and when you left and how. I told him, as far as I knew, you were on your way back to Myrtle Beach. He called back to tell me not to worry, you had not turned in your key for the apartment, and that the military police had been to the apartment. We have had no further communication from the military. Of course, Bob had to know then, and we wrote Rosemary and also talked to her on the phone about Sergeant Bush's call. He was probably trying to cover for you until the last minute, according to Bob, so I called Rosemary the next morning and told her not to worry too much about it, and we all decided that we would not talk about it or give any information to anyone. We still have told no one, and will not until Rosemary is safely with you in Sweden. I did write Carol, that's our sister Carol, because you did not mention telling her, but I only wrote yesterday, and she does not yet know exactly where you are by address. I think Rosemary told Dan, that's our older brother, and Alan to keep quiet about it. Bob got a letter from Dan written on a huge Get Well card to say what we all felt, that, quote, Bruce knows where his values are and has the courage to act on them. There are not many of his kind. As for me, my emotions are so mixed, but the greatest one is relief. You may remember that months ago I wrote you not to go to Vietnam under any circumstances. That was right after I had a very real and terrible dream, which I lived with for days before I told Bob. I think when Bob remembered that night of my weeping, He was also greatly relieved, and that it made it easier for both of us to know that the alternative which you chose meant life for you. I could not tell you about it when you were here. All I could say was that if I were a young man, I would not go, and perhaps you were glad to hear this. I do have a footnote on that. Ella May had other uncanny premonitions, the correct location in a dream of an uncle undergoing an emergency appendectomy, and a last-minute warning to her husband, Bob, not to board a train, which, as it turned out, derailed and killed several passengers.
That's part of the letter from Ella May Proctor to her son, Bruce Proctor, that's included in the book, The Sweden File, Memoir of an Expatriate. And there's so much more. He never makes it back to live in the United States. He ends up in Canada, and we trace how he gets there.
Yeah, indeed. He didn't really know about people going to Canada at the time, and his wife had spent her junior year abroad in Stockholm, so she could speak Swedish. She was the one, actually, who said, why don't you go to Sweden? So he did, and I think what I'd like to do is read the first letter that he sent back to our folks. He had only been there a day. And then I'd like to read his reminiscences of that day from 35 years later. Monday, 15 July, Stockholm. Dear folks, I arrived in Stockholm Sunday morning after an eight-hour flight. Enjoyed seeing the lake region from Maine to Labrador. Local early morning time, I saw the Orkney Islands and the Norwegian mountains, landed in Oslo, and then here.
That's just the very first part of his letter home to his folks.
Right. It is very optimistic. He says things like, no trouble with the language, no trouble with work. Well, as you get through the book, you realize there was lots of trouble. Now I will read his reminiscences from 35 years later. He is at Kennedy Airport waiting to get on that long flight. I had bought a book to read, but could not concentrate on it. I had dressed casually so as not to attract attention, and I cursed the military haircut that might give me away. I had to remind myself not to succumb to the paranoia creeping into my spine, the animal instinct to crouch, look closely at people wandering in the aisles, some of them looking for someone, wondering if that guy was going to approach me, ask for ID, and arrest me. And then he goes on to talk about his summer home. We had a cottage right outside the village of East Hampton, New York, in the village of Springs, right on Three Mile Harbor, and he mentions that in this next section. The wait seemed interminable, but I eventually boarded and found my window seat on the left side of the big jet. Taking off over Long Island, heading east, I gazed down at the Atlantic beaches. Soon, however, clouds obscured the view, and I was not able to spot the South Fork, East Hampton, or Three Mile Harbor. I cried. It came over me suddenly. No tears at first, just a shuddering in my chest and an effort to breathe normally. Never again to play in the surf, sit in the dunes, share lunch on the beach, go skin diving and fishing in the harbor. Never again to take out the kayak, paddle in the early morning fog. All these memories washed through me in long sobs. And, just to compound all that, thoughts of others followed in quick succession. The loss and unknown reaction of my mother, father, brothers, and sister. On the long flight to Oslo and Stockholm, I gazed at the Greenland ice caps, an eerie dome of luminescence in the midnight sun, slightly below the horizon, spreading a rose hue from below.
That's a little bit from the book, The Sweden File, Memoir of an American Expatriate by Alan Robert Proctor.
Co-authored with Bruce Stevens
Proctor. Co-authored with Bruce Stevens Proctor, his brother. This is New Letters on the Air, and we're with the Actors Theater tonight here in Kansas City. That gives you a sense of the trepidation that he had at this point in time because he was 25 years old. And newly married and in a country where he didn't know the language, but he did try to learn it.
He did, with very little success.
Yeah.
Yes. So his work permit said common laborer. And that allowed him to work in the docks, to work in a light bulb factory. His crowning achievement late in his second year was taking a taxi driver's test and passing it. So he made some money driving a taxi, but it was very, very difficult. He saw Sweden really as a utopian existence in the beginning, and it soon became dystopian, particularly those long, long 6-7 month winters. Hard for a kid from Maryland.
I knew that Alan would be right for today because Matt, here at Actors Theater, had asked for a poet in the beginning. And I remembered his poem, Lure, that was first published in 1975 in New Letters magazine and is now in his book, The Sweden File. David Ray was the editor of New Letters at that time, and he wrote the preface for this book. Right. And I know David was very much against the Vietnam War and actually is still anti-war today. So
indeed.
Talk about how you first presented this poem to him and his relationship with this book.
Well, his relationship to the book, I think, came about because of our relationship at Earlham College.
Oh, I didn't know about this. He taught you at Earlham?
Well, he came as a young poet to read at Earlham College, and I was performing in the coffee house called The Soul Survivor. I did a lot of singing, and I wrote my own stuff. And I was singing, and afterwards he said, you know, I have a bunch of poems. Wouldn't it be neat if you put to music some of my poems? And I did. And one of the poems, called The Face, he invited me to his wedding, to Judy, and I sang that song with his poem set to my music. And that's really where our relationship began. And we've been communicating ever since. And when I came out with his book, knowing his background as a pacifist, I sent him the book. And that's why he put together the preface.
How about we have you read your poem?
All right. It's called Lure, L-U-R-E. I remove the hook gently as if your mouth were caught in a lie. You must have wondered what rare cloud bellied out into your world, the smooth dinghy bottom deceiving. I cut you open for bait, work along the stripes in your side for meat that clings to the hook. A cold morning. My next door neighbor died in the war. My brother deserted. I fish like a crazed sea dog, until the sun disappears, clouds slice their wrists. The waters flesh into rings of light and dark. Forgive us, fish. How can we explain the pride our lives require? Thank you.
Alan Robert Proctor reading his poem, The Lure, included in The Sweden File, Memoirs of an American Expatriate by him and his late brother, Bruce Stevens Proctor, republished in 2019 by Open Books Press. In 2018, his original publisher, Westphalia Press, also released his poignantly playful debut novel, The Adirondack Summer, 1969. For links, visit newletters.org or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC, financial help comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency, and from listeners like you. Our Support New Letters button is in the top right corner of newletters.org. Today's show features guitar music by Alan Proctor and was produced with Danny Reeves, Ashley Coate, Nick Shea, Evan Lohman, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.